Hi, it's Diane. On my mind.
U.S. intelligence officials are warning of a new election interference threat, and it's coming from the same source as 2016, Russia.
4 years ago, the Kremlin sowed chaos with cyber attacks, leaked emails, and disinformation campaigns on social media. U.S. intelligence determined the aim was clear: to tip the scales toward Donald Trump. Now the intelligence community is warned of similar efforts, but just who Russia is trying to help and why has become its own political fight, which is maybe the point. Shane Harris covers intelligence and national security at The Washington Post. He joined me Tuesday morning. Shane Harris, I must say, we are totally confused about what Russia is or is not doing to interfere with the 2020 election. Go back to the briefing earlier this month when a senior intelligence officer warned lawmakers about Russian interference in support of Donald Trump.
Right. And you're right to be confused. I think it was a fairly confusing briefing. But here's what we understand. This briefing for members of the House Intelligence Committee was led by a senior official from the Director of National Intelligence Office, and a number of other officials were there too, as part of a scheduled plan to brief members on what we see as threats to the 2020 election. Now, senior officials had said prior to that that they believed Russia would try and interfere in the 2020 elections, and we can talk about what form that might take. But in the course of this dialogue, this senior official said that it was her view, and she was speaking on behalf of the intelligence community, remember, that the Russians had, quote, developed a preference for President Trump.
That was Shelby Pearson.
Correct. Shelby Pearson, who is the elections threat executive, is her title. And her job is to kind of sit on top of all these agencies and coordinate their efforts for defending in 2020 and securing the elections. And this statement of developed a preference sparked a lot of conversation and a lot of debate among members, understandably, with people wanting to know, well, what do you mean by that? What's the raw data underneath that conclusion that leads you to believe that? And it led to some confusion about whether she was saying the Russians were actively doing things right now to try and get the president elected or to try to help him. And of course, when we talk about that, we have flashbacks to 2016 and all of the different so-called active measures Russia took.
You bet.
So this kind of, you know, assessment of developed of preference, it leaves us in a bit of a quandary. Well, what does that mean? Do you mean that they would like to see Donald Trump reelected out of all the possible field? Or do you mean that they are trying to actively help Donald Trump get elected? And it seems right now that she meant more towards the former. But of course, it gets sort of spun by a lot of people in the room as more the latter. And Republicans were very incensed by this, especially the idea that this elections official was kind of, as they saw, giving ammunition to Democrats to then go out and say the Russians are at it again and trying to collude with the president or help the president. So it all kind of got a bit sideways from where the briefing should have been.
Was Shelby Pearson actually invited to present this material, or did she go to lawmakers voluntarily?
Well, she certainly went voluntarily in that she wasn't subpoenaed, but
right.
This briefing is required by law.
Gotcha.
The intelligence officials have to come up and give a scheduled time. Now, they work out the schedule with her office. Interestingly, it was one day before another scheduled briefing for the president personally in the Oval Office on the very same subject.
So they heard before the president heard.
They heard what Shelby Pearson had to say on this issue of quote-unquote preference for President Trump before he heard it. But importantly, the president has been briefed by his national security officials on threats to the 2020 election prior to all of this. So it's not like this is the first that he'd heard officials saying, we think that the Russians might try to interfere in 2020.
But now you've got Robert O'Brien, the president's national security advisor, contradicting what Shelby Pearson said.
Yes, and it's a very curious thing that he did. If you parse his words very carefully, he is saying, well, I haven't heard, and I think we can mean to say he's not aware of, unless he literally means I've not heard with my ears, but he's not aware of intelligence that backs up what she said, which gets you to the point where some officials have now said maybe she overcharacterized it a bit. But what he's saying essentially is, I don't see any evidence that the Russians are actively trying to help President Trump. Now, what he also said, though, is that he had heard from the FBI that the Russians were trying to help Bernie Sanders. And then he parroted some comments that President Trump had made earlier at a rally where he said, wouldn't they prefer Bernie Sanders? After all, he honeymooned in Moscow, referring to both trips that Senator Sanders had taken to the then Soviet Union and his, you know, arguable affection for some of their policies even. So it's very curious if the National Security Advisor, who has access to all this intelligence, is saying, I haven't heard anything about the Russians helping Trump, but I have heard it about them helping Bernie. There's some disconnect in there, and that looks a little bit more political than policy driven.
Okay, so Shane, did Shelby Pearson present evidence showing that the Russians had, quote, developed a preference for Trump?
Our reporting indicates that she did not. We don't have any reporting to say that she pulled out, you know, raw data or reports on that. Now, it's important to emphasize, too, that in a briefing of this nature, she probably would not come equipped with that kind of information. She probably is privy to it, but she would not come sort of ready to show their work. And we think that this comment really happened in the course of a dialogue, which has led some people to say that she may have, you know, gotten a little bit ahead of where they intended to be in this briefing.
So in either of these situations, if one or the other happens to be factual, what form would Russia's efforts have taken?
Our best understanding of what the Russians are doing right now is something that they did try or did achieve really in 2016, but on a smaller scale. And that is the manipulation or the seeding of disinformation and propaganda and divisive content into social media. So here we're talking about Twitter accounts or Facebook accounts that are pushing out either pro-Trump or pro-Sanders content, or that is designed to divide people, to inject political controversy into the conversation. We see a lot of these memes that are out there attacking one candidate or one position. And there is some evidence from researchers that the Russians are behind some of those accounts. But the people I've talked to who track this say it hasn't reached the level that it did in 2016, which is not to say that we should be overlooking it, but we're not quite at that volume. And there are other things that the Russians did in 2016 that we don't yet see them doing in 2020.
Shane, can you give me an example of what these bots might look like, what these fake or misleading messages might say?
Sure. Well, a good indication sometimes for one of these fraudulent accounts on Twitter might be an account that doesn't have very many followers but seems to be tweeting an awful lot. It might have a picture attached to its account. It might not. It might have certain hashtags or slogans in the bio, like Make America Great or sort of an avowed preference for one candidate or another. But they tend to be pushing a lot of divisive content, misleading content.
Like what?
Oh, you know, you might see things like during the 2016 election, of course, we saw famously people pushing the idea that Hillary Clinton had Parkinson's disease or that she was suffering from some kind of an illness. We saw a lot of content around issues of, you know, racial justice and police brutality. I've seen memes out there now attacking Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for instance, as some kind of extreme liberal who is going to enact all kinds of, you know, aggressive policies. They're things that you would expect to see people who are engaged in a political debate, maybe points that they would be making, but sort of amped up to a 10 and engineered at hitting the most sort of sensitive places that we argue about on some of these contentious issues.
What's been the reaction so far from Bernie Sanders?
Well, Senator Sanders has said after we broke this story that he was briefed that the Russians were trying to help him in the campaign. He said he had heard about this about a month ago.
Yeah, I found that interesting.
Yeah, I did too. It's it's not clear to me that this was classified information he was given. And frankly, if the intelligence community is going to brief candidates, you'd think they would need to do it in an unclassified way because not all of those candidates have security clearances to receive classified information. But he didn't push out the information. He hasn't said why. But he was very forceful in his denunciations of it and wanted to make very clear that he sees President Trump as somebody who is accepting of this kind of Russian assistance, whereas Senator Sanders is saying, I reject it, and I'm telling Vladimir Putin to stay out of American politics. But he was really, I think, upset, frankly, to see the news. He wasn't happy about it. He seemed to imply at some point that the Washington Post had maybe sat on this information for a while. That's not accurate. But he, you know, very forcefully rejected any efforts by Russia to assist him.
How soon after Bernie Sanders knew of this, did the Washington Post know of it?
Well, he says he was briefed a month ago. We learned about it much more recently than that, and I can't speak to sources on this, but safe to say that once we caught on to this, we moved very rapidly to confirm it and to publish the information and to get a statement from the senator.
The president becomes so angry that he fires Joseph McGuire, the acting director of national intelligence, and replaces him with a guy who has how much experience in national intelligence?
None to speak of, at least not as somebody in a traditional role of being a leader of a huge apparatus like the DNI's office. This is Richard Grenell, who is the ambassador to Germany. And he has served in various posts in administrations in the past, but never in one in which intelligence is the primary function. So he comes to this not as an expert, but really as a political loyalist for the president and somebody who has been a reliable advocate for many of his policies, particularly on social media, where Rick Grenell is really known to sort of get into scrapes with critics of the president or start attacking journalists over their coverage of the administration. That is his profile, not one of national intelligence.
You know, it does make you wonder whether the ultimate goal of the Russians is simply to divide Americans, to try to indicate to Americans that their democracy doesn't work very well.
I think that is probably the primary goal. I mean, I've been covering this since 2016, and when I talk to people in the intelligence services in several countries, or when I talk to people who track Russia very closely, it does seem that an overarching goal here is to make Americans cynical about the political process, to make them think that it's not representative of the majority, that it's rigged, to use a phrase that we hear the president actually using a lot. And one has to wonder if maybe it is working. I mean, we are this incredibly polarized society. And when you see the messages and the sort of rhetoric that these Russian actors are trying to inject into the system, it is certainly not engineered to make people come together in agreement around an issue. It's meant to find the most polarizing issues and force people to take sides. And I think that that is an outcome that the Russians would like to see very much.
Shane, you have, as you said, been watching this since 2016 and probably even farther back than that. I wonder if you can explain how this intelligence is gathered and whether there really is room for different interpretations as to how the Russians are proceeding and what it is they're hoping to accomplish.
Well, on the question of how is this information gathered, if we can kind of divide it into three buckets of activity that we've seen the Russians engage in. The one that's actually the easiest to monitor is their use of social media. Certainly this was the case in 2016 and much more now. There are actually our independent researchers who study this. They have access to Twitter data sort of in total volume. A lot of university scholars looking at this, a lot of private intelligence firms and people monitoring that space. And the government can monitor that as well. And there are kind of key telltale signals that people have learned to look for to differentiate what you might call authentic social media traffic from this more engineered Russian stuff. So that is one way. There's a lot of eyeballs looking at it. And the social media companies have actually developed more techniques for trying to find out when something is likely coming from a foreign actor. The second category, you know, we saw in 2016 was the Russians hacking into the email systems of the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman and stealing those internal emails and disseminating them via WikiLeaks. That can be a lot harder to detect because oftentimes someone doesn't know that they've been hacked until the information has been published or has been used against them in some way. But we can monitor for it there. And I think that many of these political organizations have had to get a lot more sophisticated in their own security to try to detect it. And the third thing was that, and perhaps the most concerning really, was Russian actors trying to break in some cases successfully probing what we call the election infrastructure of states. So here we had examples in 2016 of the Russians getting into the systems where voter rolls are actually stored.
And that is so frightening.
Very frightening, because there the concern at the time was, what if a hacker could get in and start deleting names from the voter roll?
Sure.
So that when you show up to go vote, you're not on the list and you're not allowed to vote.
Yeah.
In both suppressing the vote in that respect, but also then causing, you know, it's tremendous panic. If suddenly the word gets out that people are showing up in large numbers and they can't vote, people are going to start questioning whether the votes themselves are being counted. And of course, that's even the nightmare scenario, that you would actually find a foreign government able to manipulate vote counts themselves. We have not seen that happening in 2020. And the evidence of that is often after the fact. We sort of see these things when analysts go back through computer logs and find out that there was somebody probing the system, but it happened weeks or even months earlier.
But the other part of this, Shane, is that the Russians are no dummies. They develop new techniques all the time. So while we're looking at what they've done in the past, perhaps they're working on brand new ways to disrupt the election.
I think that's exactly right. And in fact, it reminds me of a conversation I was just having the other day with a researcher who tracks social media. And what he said was, look, we saw a lot of activity, for instance, in 2016 on Twitter. And they've seen a pretty significant drop off in the Russian activity on that particular platform compared to where it was 4 years ago. And this person said, look, it might go up again, but if I'm thinking like how, you know, a spy would think, you know, don't try the trick that you tried the last time, move to a different platform or some kind of other mechanism for sowing this kind of content. And so we shouldn't necessarily expect them to just pull the same plays as they did in 2016.
So I have a particular concern about ballots and electronic voting. Are you concerned about that?
I am, and that concern comes from talking to people who monitor this very closely. Electronic balloting, when it came out, I think, particularly in the wake of, we all remember that awful recount in Florida in 2000. People were holding the punch cards up to the light, and the phrase pregnant Chad entered the lexicon. The issue with electronic voting, you know, was supposed to be that it was going to make this easier and more dependable in terms of you being able to push a button and the computer logged what your choice was. Well, that's great, except if you don't have a paper receipt from that machine to verify that your choice is in fact what you touched on the screen and it wasn't incorrectly tabulated, you have no real way of going back and having some kind of audit trail of what your intended vote actually was. And so the experts who look at voting machines in particular, the thing that really causes them to sound the red alert are states that have switched over to electronic balloting but don't have paper backups. They say, look, you don't have to go all paper, but if you're going to use these machines, you have to give people something that they can hold in their hand, look at and check, and then go back to if there is ever a doubt about what their vote was.
Who are the companies manufacturing these machines?
It's not necessarily one company, I think, that is at issue here. The issue tends to be more that the states have these very disparate policies and there's no one uniform system for tabulating votes. There's a lot of voting software that gets involved in this as well. And what we've also seen, though, is some companies trying to now market kind of systems that can be put on top of these voting machines to try and add some kind of audit trail to them.
A number of people who share these concerns are saying we all should go back to paper ballots that we mark on our own.
That's right, because that is a mostly foolproof way of doing it. The Florida exception, they're demonstrating that we don't want to do something where we have to punch through, but maybe it's more like a Scantron like we are used to when we take standardized tests in schools.
Right.
The paper ballot gives you a lot of security because you can hold it, you can look at it, you can have a copy for the voter, you can leave a copy at the polling place. And, you know, last I checked, I mean, hackers can't come and manipulate paper ballots. Now, I mean, they could be stolen or something like that, but the probability of something like that seems to me, as from a foreign actor, more remote than someone actually being able to hack into a system.
More from Shane Harris when we come back after a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Shane Harris. He covers intelligence and national security at the Washington Post. You know, as you said, we saw lots of this going on in 2016. Do you think the American people are now a little bit more wise about what's happening and can identify and pay less attention to these kinds of wild claims than they did back then?
My answer is I hope so, but I'm genuinely not sure yet. One reason for that is we haven't seen the Russians amping up their efforts in 2020 to the point where they were in 2016. So I think it remains to be seen whether people are sufficiently skeptical and literate enough to disregard this information. And also, frankly, we haven't seen the press covering it the way we did in 2016, where I think, you know, and I implicate myself in this as well because I covered this, where I think we didn't do enough to remind people that, for instance, things that they were seeing on WikiLeaks were being disseminated through Russian intelligence and that this was part of a campaign to manipulate people. So I hope so. I think that people have also gotten more used, though, to the idea that you can't believe everything you see on social media and that it's a place for a lot of mischief and a lot of kind of shenanigans that can go on. But, you know, whether or not this has an effect is even hard to gauge in a normal time. Even in 2016, it's not clear. Did this Russian disinformation and did this, you know, these active measures actually change people's votes? You know, that's hard to gauge as well.
Shane, tell me what companies like Facebook and Twitter are doing to try to ensure that the material shown or distributed on their sites is factual.
Well, that is a very good question. Facebook in particular has caught in a lot of grief for saying that they are not going to remove political advertising or political content that has falsehoods in it, which they would do if for commercial products, is my understanding. Both Facebook and Twitter have said that in terms of there's policing content for content, which is where Facebook has gotten a lot of this criticism for not doing enough. But they have also said that they're going to try to do more to identify when a particular message is coming from a foreign actor or appears to be designed to interfere in the election. And they say they will try to move to then get those accounts taken down or that content removed. This is an incredibly daunting task, though, because you're talking about computers trying to catch with machine learning and some forms of artificial intelligence and kind of do a first pass at what looks like the inauthentic accounts. But then you actually need people, human analysts, sitting there and making judgments about them so that you're not kicking off, you know, legitimate people or legitimate actors in a political debate. The pressure has been enormous on these social media companies to do this since 2017, when it became clear how much the Russians had exploited it. And now we're seeing evidence, too, that other countries, Iran and China notably, are trying to do the same. So they find themselves in a real bind here. It's a technological challenge, but the political heat on them is really intense. And I have to say, I think that it's going to be difficult for Facebook going in particular into 2020 with this position that they will not remove factually incorrect content just because it was put up by a campaign. That seems to a lot of people, a very hypocritical position for them to take.
What would you like to see them do, realistically?
I think a lot of experts have said that they should use the same kind of content standards for political speech and political advertising as they would for product advertising. Now, some have said that doesn't mean you have to go as far as, you know, taking down an individual user's post if he or she publishes something that's not true. I mean, plenty of people all the time say things that aren't accurate in their social media feeds. But if the Trump campaign, say, or the Sanders campaign were to put up an ad on social media that contain demonstrable falsehoods, a lot of experts have said, look, that's not hard for you as Facebook to take down. And then if we're talking about that as being some kind of action to suppress free speech, what the critics come back with and say is, look, Facebook, you're a private platform. You get to set the rules on content for your platform. You don't allow pornography. You don't allow racial invective. You don't allow images of abuse or cruelty to children or to animals. There's all kinds of categories of things that you say we will not allow on this platform. So why are you willing to allow falsehoods by a political campaign? And that's a question that I don't know that they have answered to the satisfaction of people who watch this closely.
Tell me what's happened at Fox News in regard to Sean Hannity and Joe DiGenova.
There's been a lot of talk about Sean Hannity as sort of the unofficial chief of staff of the White House because he's somebody that President Trump consults, we know from news reports, on a fairly frequent basis about his ideas and about steps that he wants to take. So that's really blurred the line at Fox. And there's been a lot of reporting, questioning whether Fox News is in some ways acting as kind of a political arm for the White House. So Joe DiGenova and Victoria Tenzing, his wife, are people who have been commentators and have appeared on Fox as well, but who are also tied to Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, and have been linked up with some of these other more colorful characters from the Ukraine saga that we've just gone through. When you look at Fox News and the people who are appearing on it and the people who are hosting it, they are so kind of categorically distinct from the other networks in terms of their closeness to the White House, to the president, and to his associates. And it's really led in journalism in my community to a lot of questions about whether this is, you know, this is more properly called journalism, or frankly, whether it looks more like propaganda. These are people who are coordinating their messages with, you know, White House aides and officials and allies, including the president.
So how comfortable is Fox News with those charges being hurled at them in regard to being an arm of the White House as opposed to an independent television network?
Well, we've seen the leadership at Fox News, you know, reject this categorization of them as some kind of a propaganda arm. You would expect that, obviously. And look, there are, I mean, journalists who are doing straight news on Fox News. I mean, I have colleagues who work there who I know from my own conversations with them are very uneasy about what they see going on in more of the opinion blocks in the, you know, primetime hours in the evening in particular. The president, though, interestingly, has lately been very displeased with Fox News and has taken to Twitter on a number of occasions to criticize particular hosts, including Neil Cavuto, saying that they're not doing enough to treat him fairly. And that, you know, in really kind of, you know, saying the quiet part out loud, as we often say about the president, saying, you know, maybe it's time for me to switch to other networks. He likes this One America News Network very much that he thinks has been really heavily promoting his position. So, you know, when you see the president going after Fox News, that's a new dynamic, but really is making clear that I think from his perspective, he expects the network to essentially be a loyal arm of his message.
And his followers perhaps expect the same thing.
Oh, I think many of them do. And what's interesting is that, you know, the president has the ability with his social media presence and Twitter in particular to really be the arbiter for a lot of his followers of who is and who is not a credible source of information. So, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post where I work, you know, other networks, CNN,
NPR.
MSNBC, NPR, right, are all people who have come in for criticism. And when the president starts then criticizing Fox News and even trying to tar them with this so-called fake news label, I think we have to believe that that's having some influence on some number of his voters. What'll be curious, though, is that 2020 campaign plays out, is there a lot of people who were loyal Fox News viewers before they were Donald Trump supporters. And so I wonder if he will be able to, you know, really break the ratings of Fox News or not, or whether or not people will sort of tune that out. But he's definitely like, you know, wants to be seen as somebody who is an arbiter of what is true and what is not. And of course, you know, political scientists who've looked at this have said, you know, the end goal there is for the president to then, to his followers, be the sole source of true information.
Of course, the president has already indicated that he'd be delighted to have the Russians help in re-election.
Yeah, he certainly has not done anything to dispel the idea that he is both skeptical that it's actually happening, but wouldn't turn it away if it did, which are sort of contradictory thoughts to hold in your head. But there we are. And I think it's been notable to me that the president has been very dismissive for years, and most recently with these new reports coming in the past several days about the Russians having a preference for him. But he is seemingly willing to accept the intelligence that the Russians are trying to somehow assist Bernie Sanders. This information is all coming from the same place. It's coming from his intelligence community. And if he's willing to believe it when it is something that might be more damaging to an opponent, but not believe it if it's more damaging to him, I think that shows you that he is, you know, he's being highly selective with the intelligence and not being candid about it.
Shane, is there anything else you want to say this morning?
Well, I think, you know, for people who are confused or even, frankly, skeptical about what foreign governments are trying to do to interfere in an election, and I know lots of people I talked about this, including friends and family, who say, oh, come on, what can the Russians possibly be doing anyway? It's good to have a sense of healthy skepticism, but remember that the whole point of these interventions is not necessarily to try to go in and to manipulate a vote count. It's to make people doubt what they see with their own eyes. It's to make them doubt the truth. And it's always important, but particularly in an election and particularly in this one where we are almost certainly going to see more than one country trying to confuse people about what is the truth, to be critical, to be skeptical, and to think for yourself. Don't believe everything that you read. Don't believe everything that you hear. And remember sometimes that the messages that you are seeing, whether they're from a politician that you might like or from a foreign government that you can't see, are meant to somehow try and shape the way you are thinking. So you have to be very on guard for that. And I think now more than ever, be a critical thinker and a critical consumer of information.
Shane Harris, as always, thank you.
You're welcome. It's great to talk to you, Diane.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Our engineers this week are Kenny Pirog and Natalie Urib-Lipker. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Reams.